and welcome to another episode of What a Scream, the horror movie podcast where I, your host, Egrain, chats with a special guest every week about horror films. And in particular, we have a subject that we need to talk about, two films that have to do with that subject. That sounded very convoluted, I'm sorry. But yes, this week is, as I promised, is all about food in horror. My special guest is editor of Moving Pictures Film Club, Tim Coleman, and together we will be discussing 2022's The Menu, as well as 1985's horror sci-fi, The Stuff. So enjoy. I would like to welcome back to the podcast, it is Tim Coleman. How are you?
I'm very well, mate. How are you doing?
I'm here. That's all that matters.
That's just it. About. Showing up is like, yeah, a big deal sometimes with all that life throws at us. Yeah.
So since the last time you were on the podcast, we were chatting about South and Latin American horror. Yes. So since then, which was like more than a year ago, what have you been up to?
Amazing. Yeah. So since then, I have continued to kind of write and kind of grow my website, Moving Pictures Film Club, which I have the profound honor of having yourself write for. And that has kind of grown a fair bit over the last 12 months. So in January 2022, we launched the podcast, Moving Pictures Film Club podcast. And I kind of followed in your footsteps, inspired by yourself and other podcasters to create like a kind of audio platform to discuss genre cinema with cool people. And you've been on there a bunch of times, and you and I covered like Fright Fest, and you're now like a senior contributor for the site, which is just a complete joy. Yeah, and so that's been really cool. And yeah, last year I also had the honor of having a screenplay that I wrote called The Night Letters. Won a competition with Film Market Hub, so I've been like trying to just move that forward, pitching to like different studios. Got to take it to a film festival in Portugal, and yeah, so that's kind of another bow to that kind of film, or another string to that film bow. We're trying to make that transition from film critic and film fan and film lover to film maker as well. So. Yeah, a lot, feels like a lot of plate spinning, but all of which are good. So,
yeah, packed and busy past year for you in a good way.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so the theme for this episode is, again, it's a bit of a random one, I guess. I've been getting a lot of random ones recently, like telephones and internet. But this episode is all about food in horror. Mm. So what did you think about the subject when I broached you with it?
I think it's really fascinating and really timely as well. Like, I think when we were reviewing 2022 in horror for Moving Pictures, we were, one of the themes which kind of came up was, it feels like food is very much something which is in the zeitgeist at the moment, and whether that is because we're still in that kind of post-lockdown processing, where I don't know about you, Graham, but like definitely when lockdown one, I just beasted all the time on food, because it was one of the few joys that was afforded to us when you couldn't go out and see people. You know, for me it was like watching films and eating were the kind of things that would break up a lot of the monotony of that period. And then it's interesting that we've had like a lot of films come out since then, one of which I know that we're going to be talking about today, which are very food centric. And yeah, to me that's really interesting. So I think it's a very timely topic, and yeah, it kind of occupies this liminal space as well, I think, between being something, as I kind of mentioned there, like we derive pleasure from. Like, I'm not a big foodie, but I do like food. Like, we go semi-regularly to like the Good Food Show in Birmingham, which happens like every November, and so I'm not like, I'm a man of simple taste. Like, I just, you know, I'm happy with like fish and chips and a pint of beer, but like it's quite nice walking around those different stalls and trying different like exotic types of cured meat or different cheeses or different whiskies. So there's a lot of joy to be had in food, but also it can be kind of gross. Like, the sound of people eating or the sight of food churning around in people's mouths could be kind of triggering in life, but also, you know, in horror cinema. I remember seeing Total Film did a years and years ago now, they did like, I think, the top 50 grossest scenes in cinema of all time. And there were like usual like contenders in there. So things like the melty guy from the end of RoboCop was in there. But one of the scenes which I remember was in that list was a sequence in With Nail and I where someone's eating, I think, a fried egg batch and it just like dribbles down her chin. And for them, that was like a top gross moment. So yeah, I think food is really interesting. This sort of, like, source of pleasure, but also source of abjection as well.
Yeah, I have this thing about food in horror, kind of what you were saying, watching people eat, it really kind of freaks me out. And I hate, you know, like ASMR, you know, you get a lot of this on social media where you watch people eating. And like, I think there's a thing called mukbang at the moment where like you eat as much food as possible. And it really grosses me out. Like it really freaks me. I hate the sound of it. I hate watching people. Like it just, it really gets me. I remember I was trying to watch this, I think it's called Deathcember. It's like a anthology film. And it's like the 25 days of Christmas or whatever, like 25 days of December. There's a segment for each day. And the very first one was this kid eating chocolate. And he was just like gobbling this chocolate down. And it really freaked me out. And I had to turn it off because I was like, no, I can't be dealing with this. Like, so yeah, that always really freaks me out in horror when you see that kind of food. Like it's taking the enjoyment to the max and like people are gobbling it down and like, it, for some reason, it just really gets to me. But then there's the other side of food and horror where it's more centered around a meal and a get together and a dinner and how something that's meant to be welcoming and enjoyed and, you know, amongst friends and family is obviously twisted and kind of put into the uncanny valley side of things, especially when we think about what was that called? What's the one with Logan Marshall Green? Is that his name?
The Invitation.
The Invitation. Not the recent Invitation, the other Invitation. Stuff like that. And the Welsh, the Feast as well, that's another one that kind of flips that on its head.
Yeah. Now, The Invitation's a great chat as well. I saw that for the first time about a year or so ago and just absolutely floored me. And that is, that also exists in that space of like a recent trajectory of films where it's like social anxiety horror. You know, where like, you know, there is a social contract to particular interactions and then people start to break that contract or you start like your spidey senses tingling and you're like, something's off here. And at what point do you call it? And it's interesting. I think like you find that in a lot of modern food based horrors as well. Like where like maybe, you go to a restaurant or you're sharing a meal with somebody and things are getting awkward. And at what point do you stand up and say goodbye, because it's socially unacceptable. So it's a really interesting kind of linking some of that stuff together.
So let's begin, I guess, with our first film, which was your choice, an interesting choice I will give you. Would you like to introduce it for us?
Yeah, sure. So my choice is The Stuff from 1985.
Tonight, America is in grave danger. We are under alien attack by a popular dessert known as The Stuff.
And so The Stuff is a Larry Cohen movie about this kind of weird, mysterious, gooey substance which kind of starts to ooze out of the earth. And for some unknown reason, people immediately decide it's a good idea to try and eat it and taste it and discover that it is apparently delicious. And it quickly becomes mass marketed by big corporate capitalist American food companies and is super addictive, kind of puts ice cream businesses either out of business or like, you know, eats into their profit margins. Those negatively affected other companies hire a industrial espionage guy called David Moe. What was his name? Rutherford. David Moe Rutherford, played by Michael Moriarty. And basically, David kind of goes on this investigation into what the heck is the stuff and are there any negative implications reading so much of it? Spoiler, there are negative implications reading so much of it.
Yeah, so I was watching this at like 3 a.m. last night as I couldn't get to sleep because I was kind of sick. But it's just the opening scene, like you said, where the workmen find this white gooey crap coming out of the ground.
Yeah.
And he just decides to stick his finger in it and like lick it. And you're like, what are you doing? What is wrong with you? Like, even if it was food on the ground, why would you eat it? Because it's been on the ground. So yeah, that grossed me out. The very first scene, I was grossed out from the get-go.
Yeah, that is fair. I would say maybe there's something in the air, because I also had real trouble sleeping last night, and I also was watching it at about 3 a.m. So I don't know what was happening. In the kind of general zeitgeist at that time. But yeah, no, I agree. I think it also sets the register for where the stuff is kind of playing in, though, because it's very, as the film progresses, it's very clearly a comedy satire as much as it is a horror film. Like, it draws big time on films like The Blob in terms of like the stuff we realize is this kind of sentient creature almost, and then while The Blob dissolves people, like the stuff basically takes people over and kind of possesses them almost, like they become like kind of goo zombies, I guess. Goo zombies. But it does play very, very broadly, and it's very funny. And so like stuff like workmen like picking up a fistful of goo from the floor becomes like the least weird thing in it as it progresses. You know, there are like loads and loads of moments where people's interactions are just very deadpan and, you know, but very, very wacky. And in particular, in the last act, there's a character played by the great Paul Sorvino, who's a military colonel, playing it very, very straight, but clearly like a satire of like right wing militaristic Americana. So yeah, it's a very funny film, but very, very unique register that it's kind of playing in.
Yeah, so I watched it before I read anything about it, and I was like, are they playing this serious? Like, is this meant to be deadly serious? Because even like the main character Mo, he's just such, he annoys the crap out of me, like, I'm not gonna lie, but it's also a real caricature of like ex-FBI agent thinking, you know, he's the absolute shit, and you know, he's just so sexist, and he's so like, thinks he's like some James Bond style character, and he's just really not. And I was kind of like, is this meant to be serious? But then when I was reading up, Larry Cohen wanted it to be marketed as like a satirical comedy, but the studios were the ones that were like, no, we're gonna market it as a horror. Which I think, unfortunately, it wasn't a big hit, and that was probably why.
Absolutely. It's interesting, this was a rewatch for me, and I think the first time I watched it, that performance by Michael Moriarty did annoy me, because it's very like off kilter and like pseudo suave, and kind of feels, I mean, the whole, because it's a Coen film as well, like there's quite a lot of like B-movie trappings in it. There's a lot of ADR where the dialogue doesn't quite lip sync and that kind of thing. And because Moriarty's performance is so broad, it's just, I think when I first watched it, I didn't really gel with it. On a rewatch, I was like, actually, it feels like it's almost like a comedy masterclass about like this kind of archetypal kind of anti-hero hero. But yeah, it's very cheesy. And I think if once I kind of vibed in with that pitch that they seem to be going for, I feel like it's just a ride. Definitely, like, there's still like those moments where you're like, is it satire, or is it actually just a bit problematic? You know, certainly there's a character called Chocolate Chip Charlie, who's pretty much the only person of color in the film, and that name alone, I should say his name is because he was, I think, a chocolate chip cookie guru slash entrepreneur, but still, you know, as a name for your only black character, it's a little bit like but I think as well, like the tone of the whole film kind of softens some of those blows and kind of wraps it up as this kind of satirical comedy, as you say.
Yeah, I mean, I was getting lashings of Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, you know, because we've got the suave hero, and then we've got the damsel in distress who's trying to help, and you know, she's just kind of put to the wayside as that damsel kind of character. And then we've got the plucky kid who's, you know, Mo's sidekick almost. So I was getting strong Indiana Jones vibes off it, but set in like a 50s sci-fi situation.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, definitely. It's big kind of 50s B movie. Kind of set up. And yeah, I mean, it moves at like a cracking pace as well. Like, I think, like we said there, the opening scene is the stuff is discovered. And really, by about the third minute, it's already been packaged up and sold to the world. So it's it really, really moves at quite a pace. I mean, what were your thoughts then about the satirical stuff in terms of satirizing corporate America and, you know, relaxed standards in like food distribution and that kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, I guess because I'm not from America, so we don't have the same kind of like, obviously I know a lot about their kind of, their standards are very lax compared to the rest of the world, apart from when it comes to stuff like Kinder eggs, which is so weird. So I was kind of like not quite getting it, but at the same time did get, like, I understand what they were trying to say, obviously about America's consumerism, about how, especially when it comes to food, they eat so much crap and it's so damaging for them, but they don't care because it tastes good. And obviously food can become an addiction. And yeah, and obviously if that's what you're being given at a lower cost, that's what you're going to eat. So yeah, I do get it. But I kept thinking about, you know, the marshmallow fluff. Like that's it was. So I just kept thinking about that and I was like, oh, I kind of like that too. So I'd probably I'd be one of those zombie goos.
I'm so glad you said that, because when I was watching it, I was like, is it wrong that it does look kind of appealing? Like everyone's like tucking into these little tubs of, like you said, it looks like marshmallow fluff, what we hear. Get over here. So so it's this weird, I mean, we were saying earlier, like food should be a source of pleasure, and like it does. It, as gross as it is, like, you know, as people become possessed by the stuff, they start to have heads exploding and they're vomiting out the stuff and all that. But the texture of it looks kind of good. I was like, I would eat the stuff. I think you can buy like replica stuff tubs as well. So I was like, I'm going to get onto eBay and get one for like my shelf. So,
but yeah, I thought it was like a good kind of representation of, you know, in America, they put a lot of steroids in their meat, a lot of, what is it, corn syrup? That's what they, is that, whatever the chemical name for the stuff that's really bad, that's sugary and makes everything taste good. I mean, it was all right. I didn't love the film, but it was okay. What did you think about the satirical nature of it?
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed it. I mean, like, particularly, I think when we get into the last act, I mentioned Paul Savino's character, and Paul Savino, for me, it's a joy to see him perform this role, because this is only like maybe 5-6 years before Goodfellas and like the role which made him famous, and just a completely different role where he's playing this kind of archetypal right wing. He's either a legitimate colonel or a militia colonel. The film is very vague on some of the details, but he plays it very straight with this guy who's got all these quite abhorrent ideological leanings, and just kind of gently like winking at that kind of element of America, the way it's winking at like the corporate machine as well, which kind of will put people's safety on a lower priority to maximize profits. And then it kind of packages it all up in this kind of very zippy, very zany, fast-paced little genre pick. I really digged it. I should say, actor wise as well, we've got a good cameo from Daniello as well. A lot of Italian American performers like doing good work here as well. But I think it's really fun, and particularly because on that kind of political note, as we were saying, I think this is a very liberal film because of its critique of big business. And you get all these like little kind of right-wing comments about, like, I think there's a moment at the end where all these military guys pile out of these little Cessna jets, and this taxi driver's like, you know, what's happening, guys? And like, the colonel's like, that's enough of your liberal comments, quick into the guy. And it's just stuff like that. I was like, really, really fun.
Yeah. One line that stood out to me that I thought was quite interesting was when Mo is chatting to the colonel and he goes, oh, you were worried about the commies putting fluoride in your water. And I just love that kind of represented, obviously, back in the 70s, I don't know American history, but they were very worried about communists and what communists would do. But as we know, like, especially with what horror came out around the 70s, it was all homegrown horror. Mm-hmm. And so the horror and the badness was actually coming from within America. And I really mm-hmm. liked the way it kind of tapped into that. Like, you're worried about outside forces putting stuff like fluoride in the water, when really it's the homegrown Americans who are pumping poison into the food
yeah.
for people to ingest and become zombies. So I really like yeah. that line. That really stood out to me.
That's a really good point. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's one of the great lies or myths of the right, isn't it? Is to demonize the left to such an extent that it becomes this kind of quite abject other. And like, not, you know, I think either side of the political spectrum taken to its extremes obviously has, you know, real dangers. You get like, you know, atrocities committed by far left groups as well as far right groups. But yeah, to me, you know, things like health insurance in the States, where this idea of, oh, it would be really, really awful to have insurance for all because you'd have, or healthcare for all because you get like panels deciding like who lives or who dies based on like resources, completely ignoring the fact that in the current system, it is already that decision that's happening, but it's based not on like balancing cases, it's based on who's got the money. And so it's like the great lie of capitalism in a way that it's kind of a leveling force when all it really does, taking to its logical conclusion, is harm the people at the bottom of the pile while benefiting those at the top. And so there is an element in this film where it's a liberal wish fulfillment, where the climactic moments, for example, sees a couple of the guys at the top getting exactly what they deserve, and is that, you know, big fuck you to the man of, you know, you spend so much time, you know, pummeling this stuff out and shipping stuff out to the working people, whilst always by swearing off it yourself as well, but happy to take the money. And at the end, Mo and Jason the kid force feed these two guys like a crate of the stuff, and just, you know, let them get taken over, which yeah is a great little bit of poetic wish fulfillment, I think, for what the film's trying to say.
Definitely. What did you think about the very, very end scene where we see the stuff going out on the black market? What do you think that was trying to communicate to viewers?
That's a really good question. And I was asking myself that this morning, because I was like, is there a message here about, you know, the dangers of regulating substances, you just push it underground? Because like, this is the whole thing about drug regulation, right? Is it safer to just legalize everything and then regulate it? Because if you don't, the problem doesn't go away. You just push it into unsafe spaces. But then I wasn't sure if that 100% lined up with the rest of the film's kind of messaging. So I also kind of wanted, actually, maybe am I trying to like read it too much? Because, you know, although it's definitely an ideologically motivated story, it is also a fun schlocky B movie. And maybe Larry Cohen was just kind of, hey, you know, in real life, if you ban a substance that people want, it will go underground. So I'm not, I am still digesting what I think about that and trying to figure that out. What was your thoughts on it?
Oh, I was like, he's either leaving it open for a sequel or, yeah, kind of along the lines of what you said, like in just before that scene, like you said, they're forcing the guys who have been selling the stuff to eat the stuff. But before that, they had said, oh, we've remanufactured it, so we're actually adding it in with ice cream, and there's only 12% in there, so it won't be enough to affect people. So they're kind of, like you said, regulating it, and then kind of showing this like situational thing of what would happen if it does go underground compared to if they did regulate it. So I got the same vibe from you about it. But like you said, it was probably just like, hey, let's try and leave this open for a sequel if it does well, which it didn't. So
yeah, which is a shame, really, because I think history's been, you know, kind to this movie. It's I mean, no one's going to say it's a high piece of art or anything. And I think it's interesting actually comparing it to the next film, which I think is a lot slicker and a lot, you know, more uniform in its conception. But I, you know, I've got a lot of affection for it. And yeah, I think if you like your B-movie schlocky funny cheese with like a side helping of left-wing ideology, then this is the good time pizza and beer movie for you, you know.
I will give it Like, I love the special effects in it that are obviously awful. They're so bad. They're so bad, they're good, basically. I just love the supreme, like, imposition of characters against this big, like, foam and doing their best kind of, you know, I can't even, like, slow motion style kind of running and screaming. That was great.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's really, I mean, the special effects are really interesting because, I mean, it did have a bit of a budget. It was like $1,700,000, I think, or thereabouts. And it looks cheap as chips in some moments. And other moments, they're like blowing up oil tankers. And, you know, there's like a really cool, like, Nightmare on Elm Street style effect where a character is pushed up a wall and writhes across the ceiling. This came out the year after Nightmare, so I wonder if it was a bit of a reference. Like, in here, it's because the stuff is like gushing out of a bed and pushing them up, which is kind of a mixture of like the death of Johnny Depp and Amanda Weiss in Nightmare on Elm Street. Yeah, so it is kind of goofy and funny. And then, yeah, it kind of swings back and forth between filmmaking grammar, which isn't particularly smooth, like, you know, where, you know, it's not entirely always clear what direction people are running in or how certain shots fit together, you know. So yeah, but for me, that kind of adds to part of the charm.
Yeah, it's definitely, it feels like a, well, it is a kind of like a dedication to the 1950s kind of you know, B movies, which is great. So I take it you'd recommend this to horror fans then?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, like I said, this was a rewatch for me, and I enjoyed it more the second time around as well. And I can definitely see myself going back to it again and showing it to friends. Yeah, I mean, I think like my horror films to be a little bit more gruesome or violent. And this is definitely like, it's a sort of like PG-13 style movie. But you know, like it's just a really fun time. It's kind of, I put it in a similar kind of bracket of films like, you know, Joe Dante movies and stuff like The Burbs, or, you know, films like Gremlins, for example, those films which are kind of like acceptable for younger viewers. So nothing too strong, but just like a lot of fun. And yeah, if you're a fan of 50s B movies, yeah, absolutely rejoice. It's a good one.
Yeah, I mean, if I knew that someone was a fan of those kind of films, I'd definitely recommend it. I did like Jason, the little plucky kid. I love when he goes to the supermarket and just like smashes everything. Like this little kid who's, you know, family have become obsessed with the stuff, and his dad's really horrible to him, and he's just like, you know what, I'm just going to go to the supermarket and smash everything up.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's a good performance, and like a bit of, again, like maybe slight wish fulfillment for kids. Maybe that kind of, probably kids of Jason's age would be the ideal audience for it, where it's like you get to rebel against your kind of quite disciplinarian family who are trying to get you to conform. And I guess like overall you could say this is a film about anti-conformity and about kind of standing up against the powers that be, to, you know, to do what's right. I guess a film it also reminded me of, which is a true story and a completely different film tonally, but like the Julia Roberts movie, Erin Brockovich, about like fighting for like anti-pollution in water sources. So if you imagine Erin Brockovich, but, you know, with possessed marshmallow fluff, then that's the elevator pitch, I guess.
And what a point to end on for that film. So the next film was my choice. And I went with the recent release of The Menu.
Chef?
Yes.
I think I speak for everybody here when I say that I want to know. I mean, we want to know.
What the fuck is this happening, man?
Well, I'll tell you. Think of yourselves as ingredients in a degustation concept.
What?
A tasting concept.
Directed by Mark Mylod, and it stars Ralph Fiennes as he's a celebrity chef, and he invites all these people onto this isolated island to have this dinner that is a little bit food theatre, a little bit high-end restaurant, and amongst the customers is Anna Taylor-Joy, Nicholas Holt, who's like this wannabe foodie, We've got John Leguizamo, who is an actor, and there's like a food critic, rich kind of techno bros, and a couple that have returned again and again to this restaurant. So as they sit down to eat, they realize that it's not like every other set meal they've had, and things start getting a little bit dangerous. Yeah, it's an interesting film. What did you think about it?
I love this film. Yeah, I was really glad when you suggested it, because it'd been on my hit list of things from came out last year, which I hadn't had a chance to see. And because Disney Plus, doing the Lord's work by putting a lot of great genre movies up there, was able to catch it this weekend and just had an absolute whale of a time. Yeah, I had to eat while watching it, of course, because otherwise I would have been permanently hungry watching these people tuck into this kind of delicious food. Although, yeah, they're all eating like oysters and scallops, and I'm just eating like a sharing bag of crisps, but whatever. But yeah, no, I thought it was fabulous. And I thought it walked this really, again, like tonally really interesting. Like, I kind of went in expecting something a bit more like Karen Kusama's The Invitation, which we mentioned earlier, with this kind of social anxiety horror about people who go to have a meal in a restaurant and things start to escalate and get bad. And that is what happens. But it's also a lot funnier than that. And a lot richer. And I would say, like, maybe in its own way. Are we doing spoilers for this one?
Yeah.
Yep, cool. In some way optimistic. In some way optimistic, I'd say, is in terms of the places it goes to eventually, because what it kind of emerges as is that it kind of messes with who the villains are, and it kind of explores ideas about service industries being exploited by the wealthy, and explores the idea of people who spend their lives on something which they once loved, losing that love and their lives becoming a drudgery, and then trying to recapture some of that joy. And for me, like, those points really lifted it up another notch or two. And I just thought, wow, what a funny and dark and violent, but also kind of profound point to make by the end. Yeah, what were your thoughts on it?
I this is my second time watching it. I really enjoyed it. I didn't know what to expect when I first watched it. And so it was a nice kind of little, I thought it was going to be quite a really slow burner, and I was like, ugh. But then once it gets in, I was like, Jesus, I was not expecting this. Mm-hmm. So we find out that the chef is, he wants to kill everyone, basically. That's his plan, that he's going to kill everyone during this meal. And every dish of the meal has something to do with his life or the customers' lives. And it goes a bit mental. Like, there's one point where he brings out a female chef, and, you know, he says, oh, I once tried to make a move on her and she, you know, rebuffed, and then I treated her badly. And then he offers her a knife that he stabs, or scissors, and she stabs him in the leg with it. And so it's all quite weird. And Ralph Fiennes, he's so creepy, like so freaking creepy in this. And he's so, but he's just such a chef. Like, you know, people like that, you've seen chefs like that. And it's just like, they are psychopaths. Some of them, like, they're absolute maniacal. And I just thought it was such an amazing play by him. And I loved as well the chemistry he has with Anya Taylor-Joy. Yeah, I really liked that relationship.
Yeah, that's a great shout. Yeah, I think the thing about I think Ralph Fiennes' performance is that he never, for me, never went as big as I feared he would go. But I was always afraid of him getting to that point, you know, because he's not adverse to giving some big performances. Like, of course, you know, Schindler's List is an iconic one for him. Of course, Lord Voldemort in the Harry Potter movies. And in my, you know, if you do watch reality cooking shows, or you're aware of celebrity chefs, like, I'm thinking of people like Gordon Ramsay, you know, where I went through a spat recently of like watching Ramsay freakouts on like YouTube, and like terrifying, you know, just the way he tears into people. So you're always kind of waiting for it to get to that point. And he never fully does, but particularly, like you said, when some of that real life violence comes in, you're always waiting for it to level up to the next point. But I thought, yeah, I thought his character of Chef Slovak was so interesting. Like, he kind of like you said, he uses the menu to discuss little biographic details. So like an early one, which he shares, is about how his father was an abusive drunk and his mother is still in the room, and how when he was a kid, he tried to protect his mum by stabbing his dad in the thigh with a pair of scissors. And then like they serve the chicken in the next course with a little pair of scissors in. And then he, like you said, like that scene where he facilitates it being made public that he gave unwanted advances on one of his staffers and then like blanked her for 8 months afterwards and allows her to stab him as a way of apologizing. And so you kind of, I thought that's really, just really interesting that this whole like bringing that which is sublimated or secret or shameful into the public and owning it and allowing you to look bad, even though everything is all about looking good and tasting good. Yeah, I thought he was absolutely magnetic. And Anya Taylor-Joy, I mean, what an absolute legend. She is just going from strength to strength at the moment. She plays this character who initially we believe is called Margot. Later we realize that is not her real name. Her real name is Erin, I think. But yeah, we meet her as the what appears to be the girlfriend of Nicholas Holt's character, Tyler. And he's like, he said he's really into food, but he's also...
Such an asshole.
I mean, hats off to Nicholas Holt. He does a great job playing that character because he starts off as in, I would say, my take on him was initially a bit intense and a bit annoying, and then gradually his true nature as someone who is deeply pathetic and entitled and controlling seeps out more and more explicitly as it goes through. And we realize by the end that, in fact, Erin / Margot is either an escort or a sex worker who he's hired to come with him because his girlfriend or his partner has dumped his ass, and so he wanted to fill the spot. And you know, he brought her along knowing that everyone's going to die. So you know, he's just that kind of guy. But yeah, fabulous performances all around, I thought.
What did you think about his death scene? Because obviously he knows that everyone coming to this island is good. Like, he knows from the get-go, he was the only one that knew that everyone was going to die. But his death is by his own hand, and it's because the chef embarrasses him. You know, at one point he's like, well, you think you know so much, come and cook for us. And he gets him up in front, like puts the chef whites on him and gets him to cook, and he cooks like lamb and leeks and you know, something real simple, and he's absolutely humiliated for it, and from this he goes and he hangs himself. So what did you think about his death?
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting that it took A, off screen, like you just see his feet hanging a bit later on, and B, after that humiliation sequence, Fiennes leans in and whispers something in Holt's ear, and you don't hear what it is. You just see like Holt tearing up, and then he walks off, and you kind of assume it's something to the effect of, you know,
fuck off,
just kill, yeah, just kill yourself. But it's I think it the way all of the characters are deconstructed is about that kind of process of bringing what's hidden out into the light, and many of them appear to be respectable but actually have something quite shameful. So like the tech bros are either embezzling money or some kind of financial fraud happening there. The old married couple, in a very disturbing subplot, it appears that not only was he visiting sex workers, he was visiting sex workers like Erin, who looked like his own daughter. And there's a restaurant critic who has been responsible for other restaurants closing. There's a movie star who, which is quite funny, but his crime apparently was selling out and making a bad film. And I was like, you know, that's a little wink wink to the other actors in the room, I think. But yeah. To go to your question about like Nicholas Holt's death, I think it was about like popping everyone's bubble and going like, you guys think you're untouchable. You think you are the business and you're not, and you need to own that. And you could say that could be cruel. Like certainly there is a one of the cooks in the kitchen is encouraged and does shoot himself in the head because he realizes he'll never attain the levels that he wants to attain. So you could argue quite rightly that is cruel and unnecessary, but there's also something cathartic about everyone just owning up to reality. And just to be really crystal clear, not saying anyone should kill themselves, but as characters who are kind of brought low from their haughty positions, and particularly characters as hateful as Tyler, you're like, yeah, like, I don't wish anyone to kill themselves. I'm glad that his hubris was exposed, though, and that's where the catharsis lies, you know.
So one point that I kind of picked up about it was this idea of the gentrification of food, how it's gone from sustenance, you know, something to sit around with your friends and family and enjoy, and it being basically a ritual, which is still seen a lot of the time in lots of different parts of the world, that food and meals is part of a ritual, to how it's been commodified and it's turned into this thing where only the rich can obtain it. And, you know, you're not an enjoyer of food unless you're going to these high-end restaurants and eating foam and tiny little portions that cost, you know, more than a week's work. So what did you think about that point?
Yeah, I love this. I mean, the crescendo of it all is when Anya Taylor-Joy is trying to escape, she discovers in Chef Slovak's house, which is basically another restaurant, a picture of him frying just a cheeseburger when he was like a young man. And at the end, she says to him, basically, I'm still hungry and your food is rubbish. And he goes, and that's his sensitive point. Cause he's like, I, you know, yes, I'm going to kill everyone, but the thing that really offends me is I haven't actually pleased you with this food. And so she goes, I want a cheeseburger. And he makes this cheeseburger. And this is just beautiful delicacy defines a performance as he recaptures the joy he had as a young man. And then she asked for the food to go, and he allows her to go. And for me, I felt so seen, Igraine, because as much as I enjoy going to the good food show, or like for special occasions we might go to like a nice restaurant, I genuinely I'm like most happy with like the £5 cheap burger from my corner shop, you know. Like I'm a simple guy, and I'm just like, I don't really care massively for the la-di-da stuff. I just want like good quality cheap food and watching horror films at home. And so I just love that. And then of course, you know, Fiennes does kill everyone. He turns everyone into human s'mores at the end and burns them all alive. And Anya Taylor-Joy is on the boat having that burger, watching them all burn to death. And I absolutely love that, because yeah, you're quite right. Like, nothing wrong with posh food, but like if it becomes something which is gentrified and classist and it's kind of implicit mode of oppression on working class people that kind of elevates some food and denigrates others, I think it's bullshit. And you know what we just need is to just enjoy the simple things in life, you know, like having a cheeseburger and watching, you know, people burn to death in a restaurant.
Yeah, I mean, I guess food has become like a class and status symbol, that even food that you cook at home, you know, if you gave your kids like fish fingers and potato waffles and beans, people would be like, oh, you're not giving them enough nutrition, like you're a bad parent. You're like, no, I'm just feeding my kid, like it's what he likes to eat, and if he eats something, great, you know. I don't have to be serving him fucking, I don't know what posh food is. Like
foam and foam, you know. Yeah.
Breadless bread plates. So I, you know, I'm really quite against that whole, especially you see it a lot in like Pinterest mummies, I call them, where they're like, let's make these vegetable nuggets for children and blah, blah, blah. And you're like, oh, just give them a chicken nugget. Like, just give them a chicken nugget. It's this class symbol, it's a status symbol, and you know, you're not a good parent if you're not feeding your child several kinds of vegetables at every dinner. I really like the way that at the end Anna Taylor-Joy was just like, give me a cheeseburger, like I just want a cheeseburger, because that's what I'd be like if I went to a restaurant. I'd be like, where's the burgers? Like, that's all I want to eat. I love that end scene where he makes everybody into a s'more. Like, I adore that. And I also like the way a lot of his dishes, he takes food that is classed, that would be classed as kind of lower class, like tacos and s'mores. And he turns it into this kind of course to kind of throw it back in the patrons' faces and be like, look how kind of hypocritical yous are. Like, just because this is deconstructed, it's still a taco.
Like, yeah. That's a great scene as well, like where they use like a laser to burn in these different secret details into people's tortillas, and so that's where they get like the financial records of those tech bros, or like pictures of the old guy visiting the sex worker.
So talking about the end, the end sequence when they make everyone into human s'mores, I was getting such strong like Wicker Man, Midsommar kind of vibes off it, and I just loved it. Like, I just thought, what an ingenious way to kill people.
Yeah, definitely. And I loved like the reactions of different people at different points. Like the wife of the old guy who had that creepy sexual fetish to do with his daughter, she says thank you to him at the end, because she you know, the I mean, there's so many great little grace notes through the film, because like she that actress only has maybe like, I don't know, 10 lines of dialogue, but it's very quickly seeded and shown that she's unhappy. Like, she's drinking too much from the minute she's there, because like clearly she's unhappy, and for her it's the sweet release of actually everything coming out in the open and burning it down. And yeah, and like Ralph Fiennes' closing comments to people, thank you, I love you all, goodbye, basically. And yeah, just really, really fabulous. And yeah, I love that all like the flammable, I think it was like chocolate, but like maybe like chocolate with like alcohol in it, because it all goes up like, you know, like a bonfire when they light it. It's just, yeah, exquisitely beautiful. What did you think of the scene where we think that rescue is going to be coming with like the Coast Guard comes in?
I quite enjoyed it. I knew it was going to be like a, you know, a play, especially when the guy, like, what does he do? Like take a bow or something. Yeah, I really liked it. It was like, no one's coming to save you. Like, this is inevitable. There's no one digging you out of this now. You know, you may have had your money and your fame and felt like you were protected, but you're not here. Like, this is going to be your fate.
Yeah.
What did you think of it?
Yeah, I loved it. I mean, I kind of thought probably it wouldn't be rescue. What I thought it was is that this guy was going to be try to rescue them, and then he's going to get stabbed in the neck by someone. But then the fact that he's just playing them all like a fiddle, he's like, you know, in posh restaurants. So I understand people go around playing violins and all that stuff. And he was there just kind of playing this extra tune. And you kind of loved the crescendo of hope where, because he pretends to be a fan of John Leguizamo's actor. And, you know, he's like clearly very animated, like, and excited that they're about to get rescued. And then he just turns around and it's, his gun is like, is it like a cigarette lighter or something? So he lights a candle with it. Thought it was great.
What did you think about his commentary on the exploitation of service workers?
Yeah. Again, like I thought that was a fabulous string to the bow, because we realize from fairly early on, Margot, Anya Taylor-Joy's character, isn't supposed to be there, because when they arrive on the island, there's this other woman's name for who they're expecting. And they kind of play it down as like it's awkward, but like she seems to be okay with it. And it's only later that you realize she's okay with it, not because, you know, they're actually partners, but she's there as a job. But Ralph Fiennes is very like astute, and he kind of picks up that she's not supposed to be there, and he kind of talks about how her presence is mucking things up. And eventually, like, he says, yeah, I know another service industry worker when I see one. And so they kind of develop this connection, this affinity, although they work in very different industries. They both give their professional lives to serving other people. And yeah, I thought I loved, in a way, that the whole thing was about Fiennes redressing the balance, like, and kind of almost pushing back against those who had, in a way, created the culture and the environment where he had come to hate the thing that he loved. And about him reclaiming his love of cooking in his final moments. But also, that is the point of liberation for Anya Taylor-Joy. Like, she survives because she is a service industry worker. Like, he says to her early on, like, everyone's going to die today. You could just die with them, or you could die with us. And so he starts off as in, like, you know, death is inevitable, but do you want to go out as somebody being, you know, skewered for their hypocrisy, or do you want to go out with us as people who are fighting back and taking back the power? And in the end, she does neither, because, like we said already, she chooses kind of working class food rather than all that posh stuff. And yeah, it kind of helps him at the last minute reconnect with that part of himself, you know, which he'd been supplementing. And I don't know, for me, I just found the whole thing very moving, because this is like a far less significant point in a way, but just how it spoke to me was, I do a lot of film stuff for a purpose. Like I do stuff for a podcast, or I review for like different outlets, and I love it, and it's all a complete privilege. But I did make me think, like, when was the last time I did something like that just for fun, you know? And actually, I really valued, even though this was for your podcast, but I really valued actually just having an evening and having a beer and having some crisps and watching a movie. And like, you know, my wife was out and my kids were in bed, and I was just like, this is just some self-care me time. And just, I came away going like, man, I just love cinema. And actually, you know, it's so important just to stay connected with those simple pleasures, you know, and not get like bogged down in like, you know, the doing stuff for a reason, so much as doing it for the joy of being alive, you know?
Yeah. For me, the scene where the other assistant chef kills himself was very poignant, as a point for the way a lot of service workers literally kill themselves working and thinking that they're going to climb up in this corporate world, but they're never going to do it. And, you know, they kill themselves doing so, whether it's stress or overworked or, you know, you're never going to get that because you're a service worker. You're a worker ant. You're not, you know, the higher ups. And unfortunately, especially I think in America as well, you know, people in restaurants, they don't get paid properly, and they have to work their arse off just to get tips so they can survive. And, you know, even if they're sick, they still have to come in. And it's just hearing, like, I read like some of the stories off like a Reddit thread, and it's just horrific, like the way they're treated. And another scene that really got to me was when they bring out these breadless plates, you know, with just the dips, and the tech bros are like, get me bread, and get him gluten-free bread. And the hostess is just like, no. And they're so horrible. They're like, don't you know who I am? You know, I know the owner, and blah, 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 blah. And she's just like, yeah, no. And it was such like this cathartic moment, because as someone who has worked in the industry, like the amount of times I got people being like, I know the owner, or, you know, don't you know who I am? Get me this, get me that. And you'd be like, oh, I just want to tell him to fuck off. And it was just, that moment was so cathartic that I was like, oh, everyone who's ever worked in the service industry has had a moment like that.
Yeah, that's so good. Yeah, because part of that backstory is the tech bros work for a guy called, is it Varick? Who's like a financial investor kind of guy. And they're like, you know, name dropping him to get their way. And then he's strung up with angel wings outside and then slowly lowered to drown in the ocean. And this kind of this exquisite moment of Ralph Fiennes saying, listen, and he's screaming, he stops screaming, and that means I am free. Yeah, and that kind of redress of power from like the servees to the servers, and from like the, you know, the capitalist bosses to the artists. I was like, it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. So would you recommend The Menu to horror fans?
Oh man, 100%. I was kind of a bit sad that it took me to January this year to watch it, because I was like, if I'd seen it last year, it probably would have been bothering my top 10. Well, I think it would have been like probably in top 5 even, because I thought it was really, really great. And, you know, one of those films where when you finish it, you think, oh man, I want to show it to people now. And see if they have the same experience. So yeah, if you've got Disney Plus, I would say get on it. It is an absolute banger.
Yeah, I really loved it. I think if people are expecting an out-and-out horror, though, I wouldn't recommend it to them. Like, I made my husband watch it, and he was just like, oh, it was a bit boring, and I didn't really get it. It was just like, oh, you can tell you've never worked in the service industry. Like, you can just tell. So, it was a lot more violent than I was expecting, and I always appreciate a bit of violence. I'd recommend it.
Yeah. So. Yeah, fab. And I like that it went in directions which I wasn't expecting, because like from the trailer I was like, clearly at some point they're going to be serving up people. And like, you know, like when the guy kills himself, I was like, well, they're taking him around the back to cook him, aren't they? And like that never happens, and I was like, okay, cool. So it kind of subverted my expectations anyway. And all the better for it, really.
Yeah. So out of the two films, The Stuff and The Menu, which one would you recommend over the other?
I mean, it's funny because like when we chose these films, I hadn't seen The Menu. And so I had a sense that maybe they were going to be very different. And having now rewatched The Stuff and watched The Menu, they pretty much would struggle to be more different, I think, as horror films. The Menu is the better film, for sure. I think it's more thematically rich. It's got better performances. It's more profound. It's more violent. It's great. But I would say, you know, why not hit them as a double bill? Because you're going to go the full gamut of of human experience across those two films, more or less, in terms of goofy, silly, funny, but political, through to slick, moving, transcendent, also political, you know?
Yeah.
Which is what I'm here for.
I think if you're looking for a fun time, go for The Stuff. But if you're looking for a bit of a nihilistic Debbie Downer, but in a good way, then I'd go with the Menu.
Yeah, although you just get away at the end. So that's for me, yeah. I love that.
For everyone else, it's nihilistic, apart from Anna Taylor-Joy.
But the message then is, don't be a douche. Treat people well and try and be true to yourself, right?
That's true.
Rather than, you know, sell out or treat people in service horribly, because it all comes around, you know?
That's very true. So thank you so much for coming on and chatting about food. Where do you think, this is just a random question, you can answer it or not, it's quite a hard one, what do you think is the future for food in movies in general? Do you think that we're moving towards perhaps, like we said, coming out of lockdown, we have a different relationship to food, and so that is going to reflect a bit more in movies?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I would say I am super bad at predicting stuff, like in terms of zeitgeists or whatever. So I can't say where we will go, but I just feel like we're still very much in the moment here. Like a lot of these films, like The Menu, Feast, Banquet, these are all films from like the last 12 months. Boiling Point as well, about kind of a chef who's kind of having a breakdown. You know, these are films which are kind of just either just come out, or they're just coming on streaming or on Blu-ray at the minute. And so I think we're going to just continue to see that, like, proliferate out. And, like, it's a very broad topic. Like, you'll get, you know, another film we don't mention, is it Swallow or Swallowed? About the lady who's got Pico and she kind of swallows different unusual objects like pins and stuff. You know, you can do it. For that film, that's about a woman trying to reclaim control and autonomy of her own body. So you can do stories like that. You can do stories like The Menu about trying to, you know, wage class warfare. You can do films which are kind of like very much rooted in particular ethnic traditions, like is it The Feast, which is the Welsh movie? So like kind of really digging into that stuff. So I think there's so much potential, and I'm here for it. I can't wait to see where it goes. How about you? What's your thoughts on it?
I think we may move into an ecological standpoint. Okay. How food has become part of the sustainability argument of, you know, is obviously a lot of the time it's meat versus veganism, meat versus plant-based. And I think that's going to become a big thing as well, because obviously both sides of them do present their own problems. And I think that's something that would be quite interesting to explore within the vein of horror. I'm not sure how, but I think it would be interesting.
That's interesting. Yeah. Wasn't there a film at Fright Fest last year about, it's called Eat Fresh, I think, maybe, about the cannibal couple who ate vegans. this is nothing against vegans, by the way. Like, I'm trying to reduce my meat intake. I think there's loads of like moral benefits for the environment and all that, but like, yeah, the kind of space of like kind of satire on meat eating is kind of interesting.
Yeah, but even, you know, like veganism has become quite a class thing as well. You know, it's a class divide. I just think there's so many ways you can go about it, whether you are going at it from like a menu point of view or an ecological horror kind of, I think it would be interesting.
So you're so right. Yeah, when you talk about like that food, like chicken nuggets and oven chips, like that food's that the food of working class because it's affordable versus like homemade veggie nuggets. So, hey, I mean, people can come over. We're going to come over and we'll have some crinkle cut McCain's fries and some turkey dinosaurs, and we'll hammer it out over a pint.
That sounds good. So before we go, would you like to plug anything or let people know where they can find you on social media?
Yeah, so on Moving Pictures, we've just in February had an episode on Possession with the incomparable Mary Wilde, giving her psychoanalytic lens on that film. And then in March, the plan at the moment, although we are yet to record it, but all being well, we'll be putting out an episode on The Invisible Man, both the 1933 version and the 2020 version, and kind of looking at the evolution of that character and the different ways that the same story effectively was used to tell different stories. So, yeah, I mean, you can kind of find Moving Pictures wherever you got this podcast from, and or follow us on Twitter at Moving Pix Club, or you can go to our website, www.movingpicturesfilmclub.com.
That was my chat there with Tim Coleman, and I realized in the intro I really should have said bon appetit rather than enjoy. Sure, look, here we go. My chat with Tim Coleman, we talked about food in horror, and we discussed 2022's The Menu as well as 1985's The Stuff. So what did you think? Did this whet your appetite? Was it tasty enough for you and all those food/meal puns? Tell us what you think over on Twitter @what_scream. Don't forget to review, subscribe, prescribe maybe to the podcast on whatever platform you are listening to us on. Next week, I am going to be talking about remakes with the wonderful Kat Hughes. Whatever could we be chatting about? There is so much on offer. But yes, we are talking about two particular remakes and our thoughts on remakes and reboots ourselves. So tune in next week and listen out for that. This week sees the release of Scream 6. I am very excited, as I'm sure everyone else in the horror community is. So no spoilers though, remember. So yeah, don't forget to stay horrific and goodbye.